obviously one with a good ferry system.
Yeah, I wonder if some Japanese islands could be interesting too, because they have like animal islands.
Yeah.
Maybe. Future episode.
Luca, stay listening. It's coming.
All right. All right, well, that's it for now. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and this is Lifestamp Stories from Here and There. And today we talked about Italy, specifically agriturismo or agritourism in Italy. And if you didn't catch the entire episode, tune in this Sunday, and this episode will be out on Spotify. Just search for Lifestamps on Spotify. And yeah, until next time, happy travels, and... yeah.
Eat well, my
friends. Stay adventurous. Eat well. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Been listening to Life Stamps, stories from here and there on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. Join us in 2 weeks for our next episode. Until next time, happy traveling.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's loud and proud. Become a member during our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. That's kboo.fm/give and help us reach our $45,000 goal. Thank you.
The great noir and detective author Martin Cruz Smith died of Parkinson's disease on July 11, 2025, at the age of 82. A journalist originally, and then a writer of paperback fiction under a variety of pseudonyms, it wasn't until 1981, with the release of Gorky Park, a detective novel set in Soviet Russia and featuring investigator Arkady Renko, that he hit bestseller stardom. In the second of a two-part tribute, we hear an interview recorded December 9, 2013, while he was on tour for his Renko novel, Tatiana. This latest book, Tatiana, takes us further in Renko's career. He's a Russian detective in Moscow, and he goes to different parts of Russia in various books. And Tatiana, he goes to Kaliningrad. But to me, what makes this series so fascinating is that what we see is a transformation in Russia itself, which means that background-wise, it's always changing for you as well.
When I first did Gorky Park, I figured that was it for me in Russia. That was my Russian book. And then I, over time, got to realize that was like saying, I've done my piano piece. And I decided, well, I think I'm allowed to do another book in Russia. Besides, things were changing. And I followed that up with Polar Star, Midstream Perestroika, and then followed that up with Red Square, which was sort of triumphant, democratic Russia. And then, of course, things did not last.
And now we've got corrupt Russia.
Corrupt Russia. Now it's super corrupt Russia. And we also have somebody at the helm. And he's the man who's creating his own democracy, a man who dumped the television station that had the most freedom of all, which he sort of used as sort of a pawn, saying, of course we have freedom of press because we have this station here. You see how critical they are. And well, he decided they were a little bit too critical. So he's just fashioning, like a tailor, his own suit of armor.
And he's doing it with the connivance of the ever-decreasing number of billionaires, which you talk about a little bit in Three Stations.
I dealt with them a lot, books previous to this. What intrigued me this time was the assault on the press, particularly the assault on a real journalist, named Anna Politkovskaya. She was an exciting, controversial, fairly fearless journalist, cut down, shot, assassinated at her own apartment about 6 years ago.
So after writing Three Stations, you knew what your next book would be at that point then?
That's hard to say, because I was really thinking of doing a non-Arcadi book. But I got so much agony from the publisher who wanted another Arcadi. And I decided, well, Three Stations hadn't done as well as I had hoped. And so let's compromise in this one. And then I sort of moped around for a while until I came upon Anna Politkovskaya. As described, a fascinating individual. I kind of fell in love with her. And so fell in love with the next book.
Where did the idea of setting a lot of it in Kaliningrad come from?
I like seeing different parts of Russia. Kaliningrad is a very weird place. You know, it's an exclave, as they say, hundreds of miles away from the rest of Russia.
This is a small area of Russia that mm-hmm. is not enclosed by Russia at
yes.
all, and it was originally Germany.
It was Königsberg. It was the seat of Saxon royalty, and it was the home of Immanuel Kant. And then it was bombed flat by the British during the war.
And then Stalin...
He took that as an opportunity to rebuild it. He took all the German population, shipped them out, shipped in Russians, renamed it Kaliningrad after his lickspittle president, Kalinin, rebuilt it in Soviet style, which is, of course, about the most grotesque style in the world.
All of the German citizens were told to leave, and it was repopulated?
Well, they were told to leave. When you found a truck outside your house, and you've got 24 hours to pack, it's pretty conclusive. There's very little asking involved. It's a grotesque place with the ugliest building, perhaps, in the world. Kaliningraders are pretty sure it's the ugliest building in the world, and most useless. It was built about 20-some stories high. It looks like a giraffe turning into itself. It was going to be the party headquarters. It had been, of course, the Königsberg Castle. But when Soviets redid it, they discovered that right below the castle had been, still was, a pool of water. And so they couldn't occupy it. It's been unoccupied for 20-some years.
I read that in Tatiana Martin Cruz Smith. I read that section and immediately went online, looked up Kaliningrad, yes. and that is one ugly building. And it's different. It's a strange ugly building. It doesn't look like other ugly buildings.
And it's it looks like it's lost its head. You know, it's turning back into itself. But what, of course, is really weird is the idea that Putin came to town. Putin made this imperial tour to Kaliningrad. What to do with the useless party headquarters? Well, they painted it blue. And so when Putin went down Main Street, his eyes passed over this huge monstrosity, and he and everyone else pretended it wasn't there. It was an ordered-up hallucination.
How did you discover Kaliningrad? Or was it in the back of your mind? Did you find out about it when you were researching Chernobyl?
I don't know. I have no idea. When you're on to something, generally, it leads to something else delicious. It's this trail of sweetbread crumbs that you follow. Stories that came as an inspiration with the least amount of logic, the least amount of reason, tend to be the best ones. You know, whether it was Rose, because I saw a picture of pit brow girls, or I had Harry Niles, you know, trying to get out of Tokyo on December 6th. It's the ones with any rationale. They have spit in the eye of logic that appealed to me the most. I was fascinated by Kaliningrad and its secret. You know, it's not just a monstrosity, but it was a secret city during the Cold War. I was super fascinated by Politkovskaya, and I was also interested in amber. 95% of the amber in the world comes from Kaliningrad. It was such a precious commodity at the time of the Teutonic Knights that anyone who caught poaching amber, that which the Knights claimed, would have their hands lopped off.
What strikes me about this and also Wolves Eat Dogs is that you're hitting an area, and Wolves Eat Dogs is Chernobyl, and most people don't know what happened afterward and what it's mm-hmm. like, and you went there, and it's this wild animal kingdom.
The idea that now the population that was returned to these fairly ancient Russians, authorities came to them and said, you know, Dmitry, it's Olga, if you stay here, you must know that you will develop cancer within 25 years. And Dmitry looks at Olga and says, I'm 75. I'll take my chances. What they live in, of course, is this kind of Garden of Eden with their orchards and vodka and good Russian food. They're a very happy lot. They think they've made the right choice.
Martin Cruz Smith, so you've got these two stories, and you know you're going to write about corruption because that's what there is, and you've got Amber, and you begin to put it together, and that means that at some point you actually travel to Kaliningrad, just as Arkady does yes. in the book.
Is it pleasure or is it pain? I just am fascinated by Russia, obviously, and the varieties of Russia. I really enjoy Russian people. The surliness of it I find sort of enigmatic and yet appealing. It's a very strange place for an American to be, but that's been true for me for 30 years.
Oh, it was true back in the days of the Soviets, but now it's equally true for different reasons, I guess.
Well, you know, now this transformation into corruption and into this agreement between Putin and the oligarchs. Well, we see what happens when an oligarch oversteps the laws.
They go to prison.
He goes shake hands with Khodorkovsky. Is there a word for it? It's not just an oligarch. It's not just a plutocracy. It's a rapacity.
Kleptocracy.
Yeah, that fits.
And the Koronian Spit, that's a piece of land just north of Kaliningrad mm-hmm. that heads into, what is it, Latvia?
Lithuania. And there's, of course, a lagoon there. It's one of the most beautiful places in Russia. It's got a huge migratory bird flyover. It's got this beautiful sea. This place still exists in spite of all the sort of hammering it's taken, and in spite of it being secret, because it too was secret, in part because Kaliningrad hosted the Baltic Fleet, which is a locket that the Russians still like to adorn themselves with.
That means that you bring in birders, because birders now go there, and bicyclists.
Yeah. See, it all fits. It all fits if you give it a chance. Russia is full of these anomalies. Russia is nothing but an anomaly.
Some of the secondary characters in Tatiana include a man named Obolensky, who's with a magazine called Now and Then. Is he based on a real person?
Now and Then is based in fair amount on Novaya Gazeta, which was the journal that Anna Politkovskaya worked on. I visited there, and she still is the dominant force. Years and years later, she still is the face that they present as their public face. Their editor is not the semi-fool I'm making this. He's much more sane and carries on the good fight.
And he can carry on the good fight at the moment.
But still, you know, if somebody leaves journal offices, there is a chance that he will be knocked down outside the building and be beaten almost to death. So to work at Novaya Gazeta takes a great deal of courage.
You write books that are critical of Russia and Russian government. How do they respond to you?
Well, it used to be, of course, that they'd throw you in jail for possessing a book of mine, Gorky Park. And when I was researching Polar Star, of course, I was on a Russian factory ship and got chased off of that by the KGB. But now, ironically enough, and we can never get enough irony for a Russian story, I'm published in Russia, in Russian. I think they've decided that it's better to defang me by proximity by pretending that I'm just one more of the gang. And I have to say, it lacked something. I miss the old fizz. Pizzazz. I mean, it used to be that, you know, they'd hand out a book to travelers, Russian travelers, and saying, who to avoid when you go into the West? And there was Martin Cruz Smith. The idea that a foreign government would actually react to it with that kind of anxiety, let's say.
That's like the Catholic Legion of Decency telling you what movies not to watch.
The list. Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, grown-ups talk about, well, it's on the list.
Do you speak any Russian?
Not a bit.
You have a translator, interpreter with you?
I have a fixer interpreter with me every step of the way.
What do you mean by a fixer interpreter?
You say to a good fixer, they have to throw themselves into the story. You say, I need a poet, I need a priest, I need a, you know, somebody who I can talk to. I need to see Chekhov's plays. To me, the Russians, I'm Mr. I Need.
The character of Joseph at the beginning of the book, the translator, does he come out of sort of vaguely one of these fixers?
He is nothing more than a consecutive interpreter who happened to be, in fact, my consecutive interpreter when I was touring in Italy. Not touring, but some kind of festival. And I noticed as I was talking that my interpreter was writing down virtually nothing. He just drew a panel of four squares and a tablet. Then he'd write down something enigmatic like a cap or a dollar sign or a railroad car or whatever. You know, it could be a barking dog, whatever. And at the end of the day, I said, you know, I'm really impressed by the way you captured so much, because he would then, when it came time for me to talk, he just went on for 5 minutes, not missing a word, but using just those few cues in the notebook. I said, how are you doing that? He said, well, this is my system. Every consecutive interpreter has their own system, their own cues, and it's pictures. I thought this was really fascinating. This was a perfect code. He used the symbols that were thought up by one man for himself.
Do you pay much attention to titles?
Well, sometimes they're the right title. Sometimes they're obvious. Stallion Gate was obviously the right title for that, and December 6th was sort of obvious for that, and Wolves Eat Dogs was just out of nowhere, and that made it very attractive to me. Rose, I didn't want to use Rose, but I had to. It was the right one. So many books are Rose. It's one of the most common cues. And when you think about it, is this Jack Kennedy's mother, or is it a murder mystery? So I wanted to avoid that, but I couldn't. It was just right.
You're listening to an interview with the late Martin Cruz Smith, who died on July 11, 2025, at the age of 82. The interview was recorded December 9, 2013, while he was on tour for his novel, Tatiana. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves.
When you're assembling a plot, and we were talking before we went on the air about, you know, when I'm reading the book, I'm reading Renko, I'm reading Zenya, I'm reading all of the secondary characters. I'm looking at Russia from the perspective of where we are when the book is written and published. And of course, I'm looking at places like Kaliningrad because that's where the book is set and it's so strange. But for you, you're really trying to hang it all onto a plot and make the plot work without holes. And that's a completely different operation.
To do this kind of book, you've got to do both. It's the reason why most thrillers fall apart in the last 10 pages. I was just reading one yesterday by a wonderful writer. Suddenly he needed to wrap things up. I felt for him because I have wrapped up one story too many myself.
In a book like Three Stations, you said that the wrap-up didn't seem to work to you, but it worked better in Tatiana, you think?
Oh, yeah. I wanted the truly evil character to confront Arkady, and I wanted that because Arkady is an enigmatic figure. A lot of things I like about him. One of them is in his intelligence. And you forget how intelligent he is until you get to a crisis. There are two scenes there at the end I liked very much.
A lot of authors talk about the control of a character. In other words, the character makes a decision, or I discover the character making a decision, as if the character is someone else. And then there are those who kind of go, well, that's ridiculous. I'm the author.
Well, there have been different stories in which I did not know the end of until I got there, until I was writing the last sentence. To use a different example, I'm sorry, is December 6th. I did not know what was going to happen at December 6th until it happened. That was the last page. And in Polar Star, Arkady is dealing with a commissar who's the usual, the ordinary template kind of commissar, evil Russian, Soviet Russian, and the thug who's sort of along for the ride. And suddenly, and Arkady's listening to this cogent explanation of good versus evil from the mouth of this commissar, suddenly the thug takes out a knife and cuts the commissar's throat. I am sort of sitting back there, a witness of this, having had no intention of doing that. And then this thug says, "That was getting very boring." Okay, you got a better idea? I'll follow that. But I did not know that this was going to be the new villain of the piece, who proves to be much more interesting than the guy he'd killed.
Does that kind of thing happen often? It felt like it might have happened. There's a scene where Zenya, who's this kind of adopted teenager, Renko's adopted teenager, and this girl he's with, they're inside an apartment, stuck inside an apartment, and there's a guy, a guard, outside the apartment. And I kept thinking in that repartee between the two of them that just seemed to happen.
It's exactly what happened. It's just what happened. You know, I had this situation which seemed to be sinking into the ordinary. Suddenly, there was a comic aspect which reared its head. I'm glad you caught that, because there's a lot of humor, more humor than ever before in this book. When I think about the scene where Arkady visits the linguistics expert who's got the two Blumenkopf parrots, I don't think I'm allowed to say it in the air.
There's also Maxim the poet's Zil. Have you ridden in a Zil?
No, never. I've ridden in other Russian cars. It's a very typical kind of scene in which I'm in somebody pushes me into a Zhiguli and says, "No, go, drive it, you know. And so I drive it sort of sedately, somebody else's car, you know, around this lot. And he says, "No, drive it, bang it, you know. And they won't be happy until I've slammed this car." And then you come back and say, "Well, it's still all together." And they say, "Yeah, it's a Russian car."
The economic divide in America, which is growing exponentially, is enormous in Russia. How expensive is Moscow, the rich part of Moscow?
They claim to have more billionaires there than any other city in the world. It's possible. It comes back to the old statement, the claim about what is Russia. And they say, there is Moscow, and there's Leningrad, St. Petersburg, and then there's Russia. And that was true then, and it's just as true now. And, you know, I've gone back and forth on some of the roads in Russia. You see three or four Russians who are drunk trying to pull a horse out of a ditch, and you can see they're going to be there all day. But this is a very, very typical Russian scene, a very, very, very typical scene fueled by vodka. You know, you get into towns like Tver, Sverdlovsk, you run into really backward towns. Again, you will find yourself stupefied by how vodka-soaked the country is. I'm sure there is on the internet some kind of YouTube collage of drunk Russians. And it's meant to be funny, but it's not funny. It's really sad.
How accurate is your portrayal of police? I mean, do you really strive to make that accurate, or you're pretty much working off what you know already?
I try to make connections with police. I've been to the headquarters. I've been allowed to fire off around in the ballistics lab. It's a very funny thing. I've been in nasty confrontations with police, detectives, and just to say, you know, you think you can write about Russia as if you were Russian. So you're just a tourist. And I certainly have to, more than anything, agree with that. Then I find out that this particular detective has been reading me for years and years, and it only admits it on our last day together.
And the character, what's his name, Victor, his pal, that would seem to be very similar to people you did meet.
Yes. The confrontation between my fictional character and the real people of Russia is, to me, always fascinating. And somebody comes up to me and says, "You're a fraud. You know nothing about Russia." Then you meet the same person a couple of weeks later, and they say, "You stole my life. You wrote my story. You have taken my life away from me. Now I can never tell it."
There's a couple in Kaliningrad who Arkady Renko visits who have some very nasty things to say about Tatiana and the life that she lives, even though they kind of approve a little bit of what she's done. Is that based on real people and Anna?
They're mafia. This is the Shagelman. And I like the Shagelmans because they were such a practically a Ma and Pa kettle.
They're not real then.
I don't know. I'd have to say they're not as real, let's say, as Abdul.
And Abdul is the rap artist, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
The Chechenian rap artist. you know what? You got to have some fun.
So it sounds as if you had a lot of fun writing this book, maybe more than the others.
Yeah, I did. I love the guard outside the door who's doing the crossword puzzle guarding Zhenya and his girlfriend.
Martin Crewe Smith, before we went on the air, you said that you felt your most successful book was Polar Star. Why?
In terms of plot, because I had the thing so nailed. I had that Soviet factory ship. Of course, I'd been on this ship myself up in Dutch Harbor. I had gotten along all too famously well with the captain. And that's what, of course, set the commissar on alert. You know, and how to fish the ins and outs of that ship. I did something kind of curious, in fact, inspired by Polar Star, which was I added to my website a small, very, very short story of fishing in Tomales Bay, fishing for herring in Tomales Bay. That kind of fishing I found fascinating, and I don't know, I always find fishing fascinating. Because I'd had that so well nailed, I felt plot-wise I was extra secure.
When you went to the Curonian Spit, did you see amber? Did you find pieces of amber?
No. You got to really sift through it. It's a little bit like, you know, a roadside attraction is prospect for gold. They really do find amber there.
Martin Crewe Smith, in the literature for this latest book, there are comments about how your wife helped you on the writing of this, mm-hmm. that you have Parkinson's and it got pretty severe at one point.
It slides. It's, you know, it has its irrevocable downward curve. But Em and I figured out a way to fight it off.
You had some kind of surgery or some kind of operation?
Yeah, I had something called deep brain stimulation. It's not for everyone, but the fact is it really works. It helps to be in good health and relatively young. I was being undone by the tremor.
Did that make working on something like Three Stations particularly difficult?
It might have, but I can't blame Three Stations.
You're the same writer you were before. It's just a question of how you have your fingers moving, right?
How many times did I write the same paragraph, trying to get every letter right? It was driving me crazy. I was sort of losing control of my arm. Em stepped in and said, I can help you. Dictate to me and I'll write it down. I'm a very, very slow dictator and changing things constantly. You know, I don't know whether somebody's walking in the door, sitting down, smoking a cigarette. And I try each variation before I decide. So you have to give it a little bit more thought. You try to think in more complete sentences. Most of all, you have to make a very strange effort, taking into consideration, for example, my wife said she would type for me only if I couldn't kill any children or kill any dogs. And if during sex scenes, she could leave the room.
When you were working on the galleys, how did that work then? You just took out a pen and did it yourself?
Oh, yeah. That I had no problem with. It was just a matter of being intelligent enough to accept help when it was offered and when it was desperately needed. The process is more than slightly different, but you discover what's possible. You do what you have to do. It's as simple as that.
Martin Crewe Smith, Gorky Park became a movie several years ago. Has there been any interest from Hollywood on other Renko books, on series, on anything?
Yeah, there always is interest. There's nothing cheaper than interest in from Hollywood. Right now we're trying to put something together that would be kind of a BBC miniseries kind of thing. 2 3-hour episodes or 3 2-hour episodes. I would prefer that to a film because you get 2 shows or 3, you've got time to open up the story.
Like Prime Suspect did.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Then, and I sit there and I'm looking at one of these Scandinavian mysteries, dawdling along, and I just turn green with envy.
What did you think of that movie, the William Hurt movie?
It was okay. It wasn't what I was hoping for. And I think it was a matter of it being a British screenwriter and a British director. And what you ended up with was, surprise, surprise, a British film.
Whereas if it had been done with maybe a Russian director?
Yes, or more particularly a Russian actor. William Hurt, I think, really gave it a noble effort, let's put it that way.
Martin Crewe Smith, what are you working on now? It's a non-Renko book, right?
Yeah, it's my turn to do Italy. I understand it's very different from Kaliningrad.
And finally, where do you see Renko going? Do you see an end to the series at some point, or?
I'd like to end it. In other words, not have it just sort of finish, stop dead. I'd do at least, I think, one more, and I have a proper ending, a proper setting. What I refuse to do is the half-baked episode where everybody who has been in any of the books suddenly shows up in the same cafe. That I don't want. I want something kind of solitary.
You've been listening to an interview with the late Martin Cruz Smith, who died on July 11, 2025, at the age of 82. The interview was recorded December 9, 2013, while he was on tour for his novel, Tatiana. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves.
Book Waves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of our lungs on www.kboo.fm. Thanks for tuning in.
Cable Community Radio's annual meeting and board election will be held on Saturday, September 20th at 11:30 a.m. at Mississippi Studios in North Portland. At the annual meeting, members will have the opportunity to meet candidates running in the board election. Final votes will be cast and counted. The results of the elections will be announced at the end of the meeting. Online boarding is open now through the annual meeting at kbo.fm/board25. Paper ballots will be sent to members by mail. Again, that's KBO's annual meeting and board election on Saturday, September 20th at 11:30 a.m. at Mississippi Studios, located at 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kabo.fm/board25.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we have two men with us, one from Uruguay. His translator is from Washington, D.C., and you're going to hear their voices right now.
Agua en la mañana alquitranada, o en la noche que cubre de cartones el amanecer. Agua en los tejados anidando. Agua en la esplanada donde olvidaron sus agujeros negros las estrellas. Agua incesante, agua de a ratos. Agua en el reflejo que descubre el ojo en el espejo. Agua en la tinta de los versos que no se escribirán nunca. Agua rebasando el vaso frío y ahogado con una gota inestimable. Agua en el revuelto río de nuestra paz interior, donde jamás caminaremos, donde ni cenizas quedan. Agua acampando en torno al último fogón.
That is the voice of Miguel Avero, and now Jonah Coles.
Waters. Water in the tar dark morning, or the night that covers the sunrise with boxes. Water nesting on rooftops. Water in the plaza where the stars forgot their black holes. Constant water, occasional water. Water in the reflection that discovers the eye in the mirror. Water in the ink of the verses that will never be written. Water overflowing the cold glass and drowned with an immeasurable drop. Water in the troubled river of our inner peace, where we will never walk, where no ashes remain. Water settling around the last fire.
Oh, that is beautiful. In Spanish or in English, Jonah Coulson, you have translated this book. What's the title of the book?
Aguas, Waters.
Yes, and it's gorgeous too. So this is the premier translation edition for the Washington Writers Publishing House, of which Jonah is president,
yes,
co-president with Caroline Bach. And we are hosting Miguel from Uruguay. And so Miguel, what is in this book?
El libro se titula Aguas y es una antología que reúne buena parte de mis dos primeros libros, que se llamaron Arca de Serrín y La Pieza. Jonah eligió el título con mucha sabiduría, ya que el agua es en ambas obras un elemento fundamental. Estuve investigando durante mucho tiempo acerca de la simbología del agua y cómo fue abordada dicha simbología en el cine, la pintura y la literatura. Luego, cuando comencé a escribir la pieza, pretendí cortar con el agua, pero fue imposible. Se filtraba por todas partes, tanto es así que uno de los primeros poemas de ese libro dice, casi al inicio, todos los desagües mueren en la ventana sur. Es decir que el agua siempre fue incontenible.
Jonah.
Yeah, so Miguel said the book is titled Aguas, and it brings together his first two books of poetry. The first one was called Sawdust Ark, and then The Room. And I chose the title very wisely since water is in both works, which is a fundamental element here in his book. Miguel dice que Miguel says he was researching for a long time about the symbolism of water and how it is addressed in the movies, in painting, or in literature. When he started writing the piece, he tried to break off with water, but it was impossible. It seeped in everywhere, and it goes from the first poem all the way to the last poem.
You can't hold back water.
No.
It's like light, isn't it? It's ubiquitous. I think it's a fabulous symbol for this book.
Yeah.
And I've read the English part of it. It's really beautiful. The word choices are very, very beautiful.
Thank you.
And how did you manage to get each other? How did you find each other?
Yeah.
How did you manage to be the translator from Washington to Montevideo?
Yeah.
What happened? How did you gravitate together?
Todo empezó hace unos años. Cuando la escritora estadounidense Jessie Lee Kercheval visitó mi país en el marco de una investigación sobre poetas uruguayos jóvenes. Yo quedé entre los seleccionados y ella decidió publicar algunos de mis poemas en su país, aquí, here. Para ello me puso en contacto con Jonah Colson, quien hizo un trabajo de traducción magnífico. Afortunadamente Jonah quiso seguir trabajando con mis textos, así que se embarcó en este proyecto que se acaba de coronar con la edición de este precioso libro.
Yeah. So a few years ago, it was probably like almost 10 years ago now, Jessie Lee Kercheval, she's an American poet. She's wonderful. Do you know her, Jessie Lee Kercheval? No? She's out of University of Wisconsin at Madison. She went to Uruguay to do some research on younger Uruguayan poets, and she selected Miguel to publish in her anthology called America Invertida. And we got matched up. She paired me up with Miguel. And then I just sort of, I continued translating his work.
How long did it take for this whole process of collaboration? Months? Years?
For the book or just for
everything? For the book? For collaborating, for translating.
Sí. ¿Cuánto tiempo aquí? 10 años, más o menos.
10 years.
10 años, sí.
How many?
10 years, yeah. 10 years.
Yeah. I had no idea.
Yeah, about 10 years. From when we started, when I started translating for the anthology of Jessie Lee, and then I kept translating, and I got, you know, some been published in, you know, literary journals,
yes,
online.
Yes.
And then we had enough for, initially it was 2 books, which I shopped around a little bit, and then Jessie Lee suggested that we just do one, like a selected works. So I kind of chose the ones that spoke most
10
you know,
years.
But 10 years.
People don't understand what it takes.
It takes a long time.
Really, you were a young man then, Jonah.
I was.
And Miguel, you just raised him from a child. This is so great. Well, how do you like working with Jonas?
¿Cómo te gusta trabajando conmigo?
¿Cómo me siento trabajando contigo? Trabajar con Jonah ha sido muy fácil y muy interesante.
Easy, I got that.
Yeah.
Sí. Y siempre estuvimos como en un contacto permanente.
Sympathetic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. No
problems, Jonah.
No problems. I mean, there was, you know, a few things popped up in the book. Some, you know, translation error, questions I had about the words,
right,
or specifically
right,
the phrases. But Miguel is very, very responsive, and we would do a lot on WhatsApp.
Oh, really?
WhatsApp almost every day.
Cada día. How about Zoom más o menos, un poquito. And Skype?
We had like one Zoom, but we mainly did WhatsApp.
You know, people do not understand what it takes. I've had my poetry translated to Italian, and the pronouns.
Yes,
you know, the
hard.
Pronouns are where the problem is.
Yeah.
And the phraseology. Do you believe, Jonah, that you've gotten the cadence as he wishes it?
I've hoped to capture some of that. I asked Miguel to read many of his poems, record them so I could hear it. So I could hear his rhythm.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So I could hear, you know, the sound links and see what was happening within the poems. And I attempted that to you know, honor that in my translation. But it's difficult, you know, it's a puzzle. It's a craft.
It is more than the third voice.
Yeah.
It is more than that. So let us hear a duo of poetry. We'll start with the Spanish first. And what will be the poem? What's the title, Jonah?
Sawdust Ark.
Okay. Te descubrirán mil veces tras excavar en la memoria. Sea de quien sea, será tuyo el dormido costillar, el esqueleto esparcido entre los montes milenarios. Es el ayer el espacio mítico de tu existencia, la orfandad de presente y porvenir. Aunque en ti se posó la madre de todas las lluvias, y entre todos los rostros viste las más oscuras máscaras del cielo, bajo un abanico de tormentas, sea de quien sea, será tuyo el cuerpo a medio sepultar. Las fauces azules no pudieron devorarte nunca, por más que la lluvia crepitaba como un incendio interminable. Alboroto y miedo en el corazón de los casales, los maderos castigados por pezuñas y musgo, todos en la arena, leyenda y acerrín.
Sawdust Ark. They will discover you 1,000 times after digging in the memory. Whoever you are, it will be yours. The sleeping rib, the skeleton scattered among the ancient mountains. It is yesterday, the mythical space of your existence, orphan of present and future. Although when you settled the mother of all the rains, and between all the faces you saw the darkest masks of the sky. Under a range of storms, whoever it may belong to, it will be yours. The half-buried body, the blue jaws could never devour you, even if the rain crackled like an endless fire. Noise and fear in the heart of the houses, the timbers punished by hooves and moss. Everything is in the sand, legend and sawdust.
I love poets. Those word choices, every influence from Spanish poetry is in this book.
Yeah, it really is.
Every influence. There's magic realism. Mm-hmm. There is that haunting melancholy.
Yeah.
There is always the question of our existence. And he is in the greatest tradition, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I'll tell everyone who you are, Jonah. You are an educator as well as a poet. And you teach at Montgomery College.
Right.
English as a second language. Is that fulfilling for you?
It is. It's a great job. It's wonderful. My students are just wonderful. They're very dedicated. Most of them work all day.
That's right.
And then I teach in evening classes mainly, and they're motivated, you
and
know,
they
for
need
life.
You. You change their lives. They can function after you.
Well, I try to help a little bit.
Well, you have been published in many places, Southern Review, Plowshares, Lit Hub, and many prestigious journals. So you're a professor at Montgomery College, and you live in Washington, D.C. Now, Miguel is not only a poet, narrator, and essayist, but he's a teacher and a researcher. So tell us about that.
Yes. So, yeah, Miguel's he's a poet, a narrator, essayist, teacher, and researcher. His work has been translated into English, of course, and French as well. He writes literary reviews for the weekly Brecha, and has appeared in various national and international anthologies, including America Invertida by Jesse de Cotcherville. And since 2011, he's published nearly a dozen books of poetry.
Wow.
And fiction. And between 2017 and 2018, he directed the writing workshop that's called Puerta Quimera.
What does that mean? The port of...
Puerta Quimera es el nombre que le puse a un taller de escritura que yo di durante 2 años en Montevideo. Que está el nombre tomado de un verso de un poeta chileno que se llama Roberto Bolaño.
It's a translation from a very famous Chilean poet.
I see.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
We're learning things. Two more poems, please. Spanish first. And the title is...
Found.
Encontré a un hombre que recitaba un poema, de un poemario inconcluso su mejor poema, y vi que mientras lo recitaba lo componía, y sus palabras se escribían en mi cerebro y salían de mi boca y de todos mis gestos, y mi voz resonaba en ese pequeño mundo solitario, donde yacía solo mi propio cuerpo, mi sola mente y mi poema, que hablaba sobre un hombre que encontraba otro, que era el mismo, recitando de su inconcluso poemario su mejor poema.
Found. I found a man who recited a poem from an unfinished book of poems, his best poem. And I saw that while he recited it, he composed it, and his words were written in my brain, and they came out of my mouth and all of my gestures, and my voice echoed in that little lonely world where only my body lay, my lone mind and my poem, that talked about a man who found another that was himself reciting from his unfinished book of poems, his best poem.
That is so Spanish.
I love this one.
That
yes,
is
it has
so
that
Spanish.
Circular, you know?
Exactly, circularity.
Absolutely.
And always that question of your existence,
yeah.
The mystery is at the heart of it.
Right.
It is just so, and the word choice, they are beautiful words.
They are.
And, you know, when I hear you read it, you have the same rhythm as he does.
Oh, good.
Thank heavens.
That's
you did it, Jonah.
I did it. I
you
tried my
it.
Best.
You,
I tried
and you
my
did
best.
It. I'm so happy. Well, what is the poetry scene like in Montevideo and in Uruguay overall, in the country and then in your area?
El panorama poético en Montevideo es muy diverso. Hay poetas como Luis Bravo o Rafael Courtoisy que llevan como muchas décadas escribiendo, pero también conviven con poetas jóvenes muy poderosos como Juan Manuel Martínez o Magdalena Portillo, que tienen 25 años. Siempre lo digo, Uruguay es tierra de poetas y de futbolistas. Por supuesto que la cantidad y la calidad son cosas diferentes. Hay varias antologías circulando que sirven de muestra, por ejemplo la elaborada por Jesse Lee Kercheval, América Invertida, o una que coordinamos con unos amigos y que reúne a poetas ultra jóvenes, es decir, más jóvenes que nosotros, titulada En el camino de los perros.
Miguel says it's a very diverse panorama. Poets like Luis Bravo or Rafael Cortese, who have been writing for several decades or kind of coexist with young and very powerful poets like Juan Manuel Martinez or Magdalena Portillo, who are only 25 years old. He always says that Uruguay is a land of poets and soccer players.
Oh, what a combination.
And just remember, they won the game. There's, you know, so they're still in it. But of course, quantity and quality are different things. There's many anthologies, the one by Jesse Lee Kercheval, and there's one that he did with some friends that brings together some really, really young poets. That's called On the Path of Dogs.
Wow. So there's a scene.
See.
There's
yes.
really a scene,
yes.
like Paris in the 20s.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that's kind of what I visualize. Yeah.
I know. Who funds this? Does Uruguay have a social, nice fund for the arts?
¿Uruguay tiene dinero por las artes, por poesía?
Sí, hay algunos concursos literarios allá que muchos poetas apuestan a eso,
okay.
Porque te publican la obra y te dan un poquito de dinero, no mucho, pero más o menos para hacer algunos ejemplares. Ahí.
Okay, yeah. There are some classes that get money that some poets are able to teach in order to, you know, keep everything going.
We don't have that.
Oh.
We don't have that.
Yeah.
We are way behind in supporting poetry in this country.
Hmm.
And other countries, even Uruguay, which is not right. as much capital as America,
right.
has that consciousness
yeah.
that there's something treasured that must be sustained. And we do not have that sensibility.
No.
I know, Jonah, work as hard as we work, Jonah.
I know.
But
for free, but it's... But,
yeah,
you know,
but
it's,
I am very happy to know that it's subsidized.
Yeah.
So the poets don't starve, right?
Right.
We hope. And can they give them a living wage? Ask him, can a poet get a living wage from the government?
Es posible que un poeta de dinero del gobierno más que vivir o no?
No pasa muy seguido. No pasa muy seguido. Hay algunos casos. Por ejemplo, Benedetti, Mario Benedetti fue un poeta uruguayo que logró vivir de la literatura, ¿no? Okay. y de lo que le daba el gobierno. Otro caso podría ser Galeano, pero por lo general el poeta uruguayo vive de otra cosa. Yeah. O es teacher, docente. Yeah. Da talleres literarios.
Yeah, so it's not very secure, but you know, there are a few of the big poets that get some grants and some things that come through, but for the most part people have another job, like he's a teacher.
No kidding.
So just like us.
What's new about that? Poetry, right? We're so happy to have you here. Welcome. welcome. What do you want from a life in poetry?
Bueno, aunque suene un poquito gastado, siempre escribí por necesidad, como una necesidad propia. Nunca tuve un objetivo grandilocuente respecto a la escritura, más que el de llenar las páginas cada día de forma más decorosa. Sin embargo, la escritura ha transformado mi vida, me ha hecho recorrer el mundo y me ha permitido tener una charla increíble con ustedes aquí, muy lejos de casa.
I heard world.
Yeah,
house.
That's in there. Yeah, that's right. So he said, like, even though it sounds maybe a bit worn out, he always writes out of necessity. Huh. And he never had a big goal other than just writing and trying to fill the pages each day. But it's transformed his life and it's taken him around the world and it's allowed him to have an incredible conversation with you here, far from home.
Good reason.
Muy lejos de casa.
Oh, good reason.
Yeah.
And finally, what does translation do to you, Jonah? Does it feed your imagination or does it impede your own poetry?
No, well, it was a way. I was having a bit of a dry spell, and I found translation was a way to keep in the conversation, to keep in the craft, and it was something that I so wanted to do, to bring Miguel to English readers, and so that really kept me going. And then COVID happened, of course, and I had lots more time to focus on it, and that's when I got the majority of poems translated during COVID. I started sending them out to a lot more journals.
Oh. Were they accepted?
Very easily. So translators out there, there are some wonderful journals that really, really support translation.
And we need it more than ever. How are we going to ever know what's going on in this world if we do not unify through language?
And in poetry, translation is just wonderful. And there's some great journals, some great editors that really support it.
I'm so glad to hear that. The time is now, Jonah. Yeah. You're on time. It only took you 10 years.
Only 10 years.
I know, but look what the dedication is.
Yeah.
So it helps your imagination.
It does. It does help. And I, you know, you learn new things. You learn, you know, different ways of looking at the world, you know, new images, new phrasing. So it can only expand your own poetic vocabulary.
I love that. Yeah. So let us have a final couple of poems.
How many would you like?
As many as you got. I have a final one from in Spanish and then in English.
Okay. So, sorry.
Actually, we aren't going to end yet. Let's have poems, and I have a few more questions.
Okay.
Hace algunos años pinté de gris la habitación. Tallé las gotas con el martillo de Dufresne. Hoy todos los desagües mueren en la ventana sur. Veo el casamiento de los zorros y el cielo de Taillier. Pero también algunas veces, en sonámbulos descuidos, pude ver el sol. Hoy lo tapo con un dedo.
This poem's called The Room. It's a title poem of the second collection in the book. The Room. Some years ago, I painted the room gray. I carved the drops with the hammer of Dufresne. Today, all the drains die in the south window. I see the wedding of the foxes and a sky of Taillier, but also sometimes, in sleepwalking carelessness, I could see the sun. Today, I cover it with a finger.
Oh, that is so wild.
I know, I love this.
Wedding of the foxes, cover the sun with your finger. Oh
yeah,
my God.
That's totally great.
That is as good as it gets. Why I didn't want to end the program yet is because I want to know what you think of American poetry. Do you know contemporary American poetry? I mean, is it available to you? What do you think of it?
Bueno, hay una larga historia con la lectura de poetas y autores norteamericanos. Me emocioné muchas veces leyendo a Whitman.
Oh, yeah.
En especial su poema dedicado a Lincoln. Oh, capitán, mi capitán. Y después Eliot es uno de mis poetas predilectos también, T.S. Eliot, aunque después vivió en Inglaterra, ¿no? Pienso a menudo en los cuatro cuartetos. Y en este viaje mi intención era conocer también a poetas actuales, ¿no? De momento he leído a Seth Michelson y algo del libro de Jonah, que ahora me lo acabo de regalar. Y ahora que lo pienso, la no tan conocida poesía de Paul Auster me influenció mucho mi escritura. ¿De qué manera? Bueno, en el manejo de cierto hermetismo en el poema, de decir lo justo para que trabaje más el lector. Y siempre tuve muy presente la literatura norteamericana, Poe, con sus cuentos espeluznantes, pero también Scott Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Flannery O'Connor, Carver, Raymond Carver, y many.
That's interesting because we hear T.S. Eliot, we hear Whitman, hear Raymond Carver, but those are kind of classic at this point. So that what we need is contemporary poetry written in 2020 and 2024, and that's why translation is essential. Because it would be nice if he knew the fabric of American poetry today. So absolutely, he has the classics down. And what we need is more daily translations going on. We've got to get that bridge.
We were talking a little bit about some other poets, Anne Sexton, Sylvia Plath.
But they're still from the 50s.
That's true. But
they're
important,
essential. Essential poets.
They're essential, true.
Now, I mean, Jonah needs to be known, and now he is. Is he known in Uruguay?
No, I doubt that.
even from this?
I don't think so, no.
Montevideo, do they know Jonah?
Me conoce a mí en Montevideo.
Si te conoce la voz en Montevideo.
Sí.
You two are so used to talking to each other.
I know, sorry.
Y más que nada mi grupo de poetas amigos, claro, escritores amigos. My group.
Your group.
In this group with some friends. So it's something.
It will grow. It will grow as the book gets around.
Crece.
So we will have a final. Now we will have another final poem. Do you have one?
Another poem.
Just choose one.
Sí, elige lo que quieras.
How about The Library of Rain?
Oh, you want to do that one? Okay.
53.
Pluvioteca.
Pluvioteca.
Do you want to...
52.
Do you want to read it in English and have him... We'll end up in Spanish? Because I like the idea of the water carrying through the theme.
And maybe, can I just talk a little bit about the poem?
Please.
So, there's a few things mentioned here. Thiago Roca is a poet. Another poet, Laura, who's actually a very good friend of his in Uruguay, and she helped me with some translation. Pizarnik, un poeta.
Poeta argentina, argentinian.
Argentine poet. Cortazar.
Peri Rossi, poeta uruguayo.
Yeah, so there are some poets that are, in this Library of Rain.
Oh, absolutely.
Library of Rain. Nothing. Thiago Roco on the first shelf, with Laura and her calling water by its name. The Bible floods universally. It rains in a verse from Pizarnik, in an excerpt of Cortazar, in a poem by Peri Rossi. There is no dust but drops and moss and intertextual ravines. The pages are not forgotten. They fog up.
Bellissima. That's Italian. So they are the voices. You have heard the voices of Jonah, and now you're going to hear Miguel.
Nada te ahorroca en el primer estante, junto a Laura y su llamar al agua por su nombre. La Biblia diluvia universal. Llueve en un verso de Pizarnik, en un fragmento de Cortázar, en un poema de Peri Rossi. No hay polvo sino gotas y musgo y cañadas intertextuales. Las páginas no se olvidan, se empañan.
The voices of Miguel Avero and Jonah Colson. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We wish to thank the Rivada Foundation, the Sinibit Fund, and Friends of the Library, Natalie Canavore, Sandy Jackson Cohen, and Aviday Shoshani. And we want to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. Mike Turpin's their engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.
listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from Stage 722 and Josh Tatafi, presenting the Date Night Tour live in Portland on Wednesday, September 3rd at Stage 722 on Southeast 10th Avenue.